Welcome to today's program titled Trade Secrets, Restrictive Covenants, and the NLRB. Can they peacefully coexist? At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general informational purposes only. You are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachment, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Jim McNary. You may begin.
All right. Thank you very much. Good morning or good afternoon, everyone, depending on the time zone you're in. Thank you for joining us today. I'd like to just briefly introduce my colleagues who will be joining me in this presentation. Gary Glazier, a partner in New York, who specializes in various things, but including non-compete and trade secret matters, in addition to NLRB matters. Mark Jacobs in Chicago, who also practices in all the areas that we will be covering today, but has a particular focus in the NLRB and related matters. And myself, and I practice out of the Sacramento and San Francisco offices, and my primary focus and practice is trade secret litigation, non-compete matters, and the like. So we have a full program today, and we have a frankly unique opportunity just based on a convergence of legislative occurrences that have happened over the last year, and more particularly that are about to happen still yet. So first, we're going to set the stage and just briefly go over some of what we refer to as the nuts and bolts, trade secrets nuts and bolts, with an emphasis on those things that really relate to the NLRB aspects and some of the dynamics that are happening in that space. In particular, there's some interrelation, so to speak, between the Defend Trade Secrets Act that is on the verge of becoming law. There are also some restrictive covenant issues that clearly overlap with the NLRB and some of its focus. The National Labor Relations Act and implications of a important decision, Browning-Ferris, that, again, has some impact on how folks, organizations, protect their confidential and trade secret information. A deeper dive on the NLRB will be another focus, and more particularly on Section 7 rights under the NLRA and concerted activity and how one's right as an employee, for example, may not always square exactly with an employer's desire to protect their confidential and trade secret information. We will then take a deeper dive into the Browning-Ferris decision, which really had some deep implications and far-reaching implications for joint employer status. And we're going to take a quick look in a meaningful way at how that decision may impact employers' ability to most zealously protect their confidential and trade secret information. And then we will wrap up with a best practices set of principles that run across these subject matter areas to hopefully give you some useful tools that you can use on a going forward basis to protect confidential and trade secret information. So with that said, jumping into what is a trade secret, and it really is a statutory creation on the state side. You have the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which is not a federal act. These are various acts adopted by almost all the states in the United States. You can see the outliers there. The Federal Defend Trade Secrets Act, which is not yet law, but we expect really any day now for it to become law, is an important piece of federal legislation that President Obama is expected to sign after Congress has passed it on April 27th. The DTSA really is an expansion of the Economic Espionage Act that has been several years in coming. There's been a lot of concern from a business perspective about the ability to protect trade secrets and particularly to secure jurisdiction over foreign actors who are misappropriating information and sometimes have not been subject to jurisdiction in the United States. It also provides uniformity and a number of other benefits to employers to access the federal courts as a plaintiff and the benefits that some think flow through that. There are several similarities as far as the subject matter that is protected between the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, the state regime, and the DTSA. Injunctive relief is similar as far as threatened misappropriation as well as actual misappropriation. There is a seizure order provision in the DTSA that we won't take a deep dive into. That's a subject for another day, but is unique to the DTSA and is not likely to be easily obtained, but is a new tool for imminent harm that might occur to the trade secret holder. And importantly for today's discussion is the topic of whistleblower immunity under the DTSA and notice requirements that are linked to whistleblower immunity. Those notice requirements fall to employers, and there's specific requirements under the DTSA that the information that a employee can seek whistleblower protection become part of non-disclosure agreements that seek to protect confidential information. Very important provision from an employer's perspective, really out of self-interest, but also in ways that transcend confidential information protection in the context of employer-employee, but also have overlaps with the NLRB's focus on Section 7 rights and giving notice to folks about what conduct that is employees, what conduct they can and cannot engage in. So going to the subject of what is a trade secret, this is an excerpt from the Uniform Trade Secret Act as enacted in California. And this is a fairly common formulation. This is some of the preparatory language as to what a trade secret is from the federal act. So in the federal act, as you can see from the prior slide under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, it's really all forms of information. Information is key, that is financial, business, scientific, technical, so on and so forth, that is stored and used in hard copy or electronically, and that the information that is subject to trade secret protection, the owner must have taken reasonable measures, very important component, to keep the information secret. And that information derives economic value, actual or potential, from not generally being known or readily ascertainable by another person who can obtain economic value from the disclosure or use of the information. So very close to a lot of the state formulations of what is a trade secret. Here is a list of the types of information in more specific detail that have been held under the state acts to constitute trade secret protection. Not all state acts recognize ideas as trade secret protectable. California does, and the expectation will be that under the federal act that likewise is likely to be protectable. So reasonable measures, key component of both statutory regimes. The Federal Act also builds in this component. And by the way, the Federal Act doesn't preempt the state body law. And so there are possibilities for a plaintiff to choose where it wants to bring its action. For example, under the state regime, there are some jurisdictions that still honor and recognize the inevitable disclosure doctrine under the trade secret body of law. That is not a component of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And so sometimes there will be strategic decisions to make about which jurisdiction you want to be into. As to the reasonable measures component, this is important because it really is something that organizations should take quite seriously. We always advise our clients to take a cradle-to-grave approach, really think about the protection of information from the minute a new employee is considered to when they start, throughout their employment, and exiting. The leading indicator under the state law regime of whether one has engaged in reasonable measures to protect their trade secrets is a confidentiality agreement. And that will become a theme here today as far as a focus on non-disclosure or confidentiality agreements and related policies. So notable differences, some of them I've already highlighted, but for a more specific look at the whistleblower provision under the Federal Act, it allows immunity for confidential disclosure, and again, it needs to be a confidential disclosure, of trade secret to a government official or to an attorney for the sole purpose of reporting or investigating a suspected violation of law. Now, that can be suspected violation of criminal law or civil law. As the next bullet point shows, use of a trade secret in a lawsuit claiming retaliation by an employer for reporting a suspected violation of law. So this notice requirement is really important, as I had said just a moment ago. The employer must provide notice of immunity in any contract or agreement with the employee concerning trade secret or confidential information. It's presumed met where the employer provides a confidentiality agreement, a cross-reference to a policy provided to the employee that sets forth the employer reporting policy for suspected violations of law. Importantly, failure to provide notice, the employer will be precluded from obtaining exemplary damages under the Federal Act or attorney's fees for misappropriation. And that takes us to the restrictive covenants nuts and bolts, and my partner Gary Glazer will take over this part of the presentation.
Thank you, Jim. So what is a restrictive covenant provision? There are three basic types of provisions often found in employer or employee agreements: a general non-competition agreement that precludes competition during and after employment, referred to at times as interim or post-term covenants; a customer non-solicitation provision, which prohibits solicitation of customers or clients or vendors post-employment; and an employee non-solicit, which prohibits former employees from soliciting his or her former colleagues at the prior place of employment. You'll see in the next slide when we get to it that there are two outliers in the 50 states, California and North Dakota, that do not line up with the rest of the states in allowing general non-compete agreements. You should also be aware, but consult with your California counsel if you are in California or operating there, that under the California Business and Professions Code, Section 16600, which is the general non-competition prohibition, an outright customer non-solicitation, you shall not solicit customers of your employer, is viewed as paramount to a general non-compete and is considered to be generally, presumptively unlawful as an unlawful non-compete agreement in California. On the other hand, because California is one of those states that has adopted the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, if one were to have a provision that said, thou shalt not utilize trade secrets in order to solicit customers of your employer after you are separated, there is a position in California, there is a group that believes that is permissible, and there are courts that do presume that such a provision would be permissible because of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, but it is a gray area. Also, many jurisdictions don't regard employee non-solicits as true non-competes and therefore don't subject them to the same kind of scrutiny. The vast majority, as I noted, allow some form of non-competition agreement. 48 of 50 states allow non-competes, but outliers, as I noted, are California and North Dakota. Nearly all courts analyze three factors in determining enforceability of a non-compete, and the reasonableness of such provisions in each case is what the courts analyze. The first one is whether the agreement is based on a protectable interest. And generally recognized protectable or legitimate business interests to support a non-compete are trade secrets, confidential information, and or goodwill. Some states do not recognize all of those, and some states, New York in particular, will differentiate between true trade secrets under the common law definition, which applies there, and confidential information, which may not rise to the level of trade secrets and which therefore may not provide support for a non-compete agreement. The second category of factors is the geographic scope of the restriction, again, its reasonableness, and in many states, a customer restriction will be accepted as a substitute for a geographic. So if it doesn't say you shall not solicit customers of the employer within the greater metropolitan area of New York, but instead says you shall not solicit customers whom you serviced during the period of time that you were your last 12 months of employment, many courts will enforce that kind of a restriction in lieu of a geographic. And of course, the duration of the restriction is also the third factor. Reasonableness, again, is the key. The facts and circumstances of the case will determine its enforceability, and the amount of time that courts will recognize as being legitimate to support a non-compete varies widely state by state. We thought this was a very interesting cartoon because in many cases it is appropriate if you're sitting in the seat of the employer, upset at you for breaching the non-compete? Of course not, as the boss gets ready to lower the employee into the alligator pit. In addition to statutes and the Defend Trade Secrets Act that Jim was good enough to tell us about, the federal government, in particular the president and his vice president, have taken a stance recently to give increased scrutiny to non-compete agreements. In fact, the Obama administration very recently released a report that had been prepared by the Treasury Department about unfair non-compete agreements that some workers are forced to sign. And the Obama administration's position was that although the rationale behind the agreements which prohibit employees from working for a competing company for a period of time after leaving a job is to encourage innovation by preventing workers with trade secrets from taking them, their position is that while they may play a beneficial role when used in an appropriate limited way, evidence suggests that in certain cases, non-competes can reduce the welfare of workers and hamper the efficiency of the economy as a whole, limiting mobility and inhibiting innovation. And the key focus of that report was on particularly on lower wage earners. And in fact, Vice President Biden very recently posted a Facebook page in which he too echoed the Treasury's criticisms on general non-competes. Recent media attention is also not favorable in coverage of non-compete litigation and the imposition of non-competes on lower wage earners. And the fact of the matter is, if you go into court to enforce a non-compete, when unemployment is up, many judges, for their own reasons, will say, I just don't think it's fair to have this person sit on the beach when employment is at a low. And with that, I will pass the baton to my colleague, Mark.
Hello. An associate general counsel who had responsibility for labor and employment and trade secret intellectual property protection was on vacation and was walking along the beach and came upon the proverbial brass lamp, picked up the brass lamp, rubbed it, out popped the genie. Genie says to the AGC, you get one wish. Thank you for letting me out of the lantern. One wish, I thought I'd get three wishes. Nope, I only give one wish and there is no negotiation. AGC thought for a moment and said, I'd like peace in the Middle East. The genie looked at the person and said, peace in the Middle East? There are all those countries and religions and factions. I don't know that I can do that. Isn't there anything else that you want? And the attorney thought for a moment and said, yes, I'd like to come up with a way to avoid unfair labor practices from the National Labor Relations Board and protect our trade secrets at the same time. The genie thought for a moment and then responded, maybe we should talk about the Middle East. One of the major themes in labor and employment over the last few years is with unionization and private sector employment that has dropped and is now stabilized at its historically low levels. The National Labor Relations Board has engaged in a variety of other activities in order to make itself more relevant. Some of those things we're going to talk about in the remainder of today's program, such as the protections of protected concerted activities, scrutinizing employer policies, the recent Browning-Ferris decision, and an increased focus on joint employer issues. In addition, the NLRB has been more focused and more public in recent years, and they have really tried to find ways to cause, frankly, more havoc for our employers. What I want to start with is the basics about the National Labor Relations Act. The law it issues is the National Labor Relations Act. It's enforced by a federal government agency called the National Labor Relations Board, and the Act protects an individual's right to certain categories. We think of form, join, and assist labor organizations, in other words, unions and bargaining collectively and in organizing. But the critical one and the key one for our purposes today is the fourth bullet, to engage in other concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. It's what we commonly refer to as protected concerted activities. Also gives employees the right to refrain from those activities. The thing that you need to remember among the concept of protected and concerted activities that we're going to deal with in a moment is that the law applies to unionized and non-unionized employers and workplaces alike. Individuals can engage in protected concerted activity without any union presence or union activity whatsoever. Here's the definition of protected concerted activity, but let's use a simple example to kind of lay this out and then talk about the definition. And this is an almost true story in a non-union workplace. Greg and Vicky were detailers at an auto facility. The detailers were paid an hourly rate and a per-car bonus. They were paid a higher rate when a team member was absent because they worked in small teams and because the employees had to work more and work harder when one of their team members was absent. So when an employee was absent, there was more work for the rest of the team. One day, Greg and Vicky went to their manager and complained that they want more money because Joe, another member of their team, was always, quote, always absent, close quote. The manager, in response, sent Greg and Vicky home for the day. The questions are, is this protected concerted activity, and should the manager have sent the person home? I suspect that many of your workforces have probably faced some variation of this type of complaint, and if you haven't, I can assure you that your frontline supervisors likely have. So now let's look at the slide and go through the analysis. The activity must be both protected and concerted. First, protected means employees acting together for collective bargaining or mutual aid or protection. So in this case, they were certainly talking about their compensation, their wages, so the activity was protected. Next, it has to be protected, it has to be peaceful and lawful activity. It can't be a takeover, sabotage, violence involved, things like that. Once again, here was a peaceful conversation. The two employees went in and talked to their manager. So the first prong is that it is protected activity. The second question is, was it concerted? Concerted activity is going to be activity by two or more employees with an object of group action or group issues. In this case, it was two or more employees who went in to talk to the manager. So it was, and it related to issues involving both of them and potentially more employees. So it was concerted activity. Individual action can be concerted as well. So for example, if the two of them went in, but only one of them spoke, but they were talking about an issue that involved both of them. Similarly, if only one of them went in to speak to the manager, but the other one stayed out and continued to work, but was that individual was speaking for both of them or for the employees generally, that can be concerted activity as well. So we're talking about group action by employees. It's generally group activity. It must be protected. It must be to further an issue of common interest. It must be done in a legitimate way. And the board term in many cases has been that the activity or the way it's handled can't be quote unquote reprehensible. That's the board word, to lose protection. And it must be for a common legal work-related objective. So it's got to be about wages, hours, or other terms and conditions of employment. If the person is engaging in that type of activity, it is unlawful and a violation of the Act to discriminate or retaliate against the individual or to harass the individual because he or she has engaged in protected concerted activity. Hence, in the example I gave, sending Greg and Vicky home likely violated the Act. This is the root now of a significant number of charges at the NLRB. The concept of protected and concerted activity outside of the union relationship. 20 years ago, virtually all charges against employers were by unions. Now a significant percentage, I think I looked for several days recently and saw that about a third of the charges were filed by individuals rather than unions. And so it is likely that the vast majority of those charges are claims of protected concerted activities and are likely in a non-union environment. With that, let's turn from these general concepts to how these issues are being applied in the workplace with regards to employment agreements and policies. The NLRB is increasingly scrutinizing employers' written policies for potential interference with employees' rights under the National Labor Relations Act and employees' rights to engage in protected concerted activity. Handbook rules and policies and agreements that look reasonable on their face are increasingly found to be unlawful interference with employees' rights. There are a number of policies the board is often targeting for an examination of whether they contain provisions that interfere with or potentially chill employees in the free exercise of their rights. Examples include confidentiality policies, internet and social media policies, respectful conduct, no gossip policies, no disparaging remark policies, solicitation distribution policies. Here is the general test applied by the board, although it goes back to 2004 decision. It has been applied much more aggressively in recent years, and it applies in both the union and non-union setting. A rule or policy or a provision is unlawful if it expressly restricts Section 7 activities. For example, you have a rule or policy that requires an employee to keep his or her compensation confidential. It will be unlawful if the rule, provision, or policy, if employees would reasonably believe it to restrict those rights. So it's an objective standard, but I forewarn you now that these policies, these provisions, are going to be construed against the employer. it will be unlawful if it was established in response to union activity. So, for example, you don't have any such policy or provision, and all of a sudden you learn that there's union organizing activity at your workplace or at your facility, and now you implement the policy or the rule. And fourth, it's unlawful if it's neutral, but it's been applied to restrict Section 7 rights. So, for example, you have this very general, vague policy that just says to keep confidential information confidential, and we'll talk about some issues related to that, kind of the problems with that type of a policy in a moment or two. But if you have that vague a policy, but then an employee is disciplined for telling somebody his or her salary, now you've applied a very general, vague, neutral policy to a specific right that the employee has. The potential restrictions on section rights have been applied in a wide variety of contexts: confidential information agreements, restrictive covenant agreements, policies, social media policies, and we're going to touch on each of those in my remaining time. A couple of general concepts have emerged from the board decisions. First, the board has found unlawful broad prohibitions on sharing confidential or proprietary information online, or on making negative or inappropriate or disrespectful comments. Second, broad prohibitions from using the employer's name or trademark or requiring employer permission for doing so is also unlawful. An employer may be able to require an employee to state she is not speaking on the company's behalf, for example, without violating the NLRB. It is important that policies be specific about what is confidential or proprietary or trade secret. Providing examples is best, but remember that, as we'll talk about in a moment when we talk about the Victory Casino case, that those specifics should not include things that an employee is entitled to discuss. With the policies and agreements in the NLRB spotlight, we kind of see a continuum: unlawful, lawful, sometimes gray area. The points being that broad prohibitions on disparaging employees or other employees or disparaging management or the employer, including in social media, is not going to be permitted and will violate the act. Things like think carefully before friending or civility codes are also unlawful. You certainly are entitled to apply your sexual harassment or your non-harassment policies. Those are lawful, but you need to be careful about going beyond those. Similarly, the NLRB scrutinizes policies closely when they have including but not limited to language, even if there is a description or specifics. Employers often think about using savings clauses. Savings clauses are a good idea, a disclaimer that this does not prohibit the discussion of information regarding wages, benefits, or other terms and conditions of employment. But if it's overbroad and you try and talk out of both sides of your mouth, in a sense, in those provisions, that's not going to protect an unlawful language. The breadth of the definition is often going to be key. With that, let's touch on the most recent decision, which is the Victoria Casinos 2 case, which was decided less than 1 month ago. In this case, the NLRB reaffirmed that employers can discuss wages, hours, and terms and conditions with each other, including other employees, and with third parties, including unions, government agents and agencies, and the public. And by the public, if one reads the decision and in context with other decisions, the public means, for example, through social media. I want to take one breath for a moment for those of you who are seeking to receive credit of CLE. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS3850. Once again, the code is SS3850. In Victory Casinos, the employer had a confidential information policy and a confidential information agreement. The NLRB held that both violated the Act. The definition of confidential information in the agreement contained a prohibition, defined confidential information as all information about past or present employees or individuals and groups of employees. The policy included examples of confidential information, including compensation data, comp and bonus, and disciplinary actions. All of these things are wages, benefits, and other terms and conditions of employment. I want to take now a moment to just give you a sense of the gamut, because application has run the gamut to handbooks, policies, employment agreements, confidentiality agreements, and even non-compete and moonlight agreements. Just a couple of examples. We've talked about employee handbooks and policies and the different types of policies to which it applies earlier. Employment agreements, including confidential information and non-disparagement provisions. Confidential information agreements in the FlexFrac logistics decision, where the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals enforced an NLRB decision finding unlawful prohibition on a disclosure of, and one of the things was personnel information, finding that that was too broad. The NLRB has even extended this potentially to non-competes and moonlighting provisions in the Thermal Tech case, where the issue arose, where the union argued that the provision was too broad because it might cause an employee, and the individual argued that it might cause an employee to feel that they couldn't go to work for a union, for example, to help the union organize the facility. The NLRB sent the matter back for further investigation to determine how it was being applied. Finally, social media has been a huge issue for the NLRB, and these same principles are applied to the social media context relating to social media posts about terms and conditions of employment. The board is held in Triple Play Sports Bar and Grill that liking a post constitutes protected concerted activity. On the other hand, posts about individual gripes, because it's not protected concerted, it's not concerted activity, may not be protected. Or similarly, when the posts go beyond the pale, are insubordinate, are telling people how to ruin the business and things like that, may go too far and constitute the reprehensible conduct that the board has spoken about. In conclusion, it's important to re-review your policies, your handbooks, and agreements to comport with current NLRB standards. Thank you. I'm now going to turn it back over to Gary.
Thank you, Mark. Mark was talking about protected concerted activity under the Act. There is another part of the National Labor Relations Act that has recently gotten a lot of attention, which involves not the employees, but employers specifically. And this was the Browning-Ferris Industries case, and it deals with potential implications for employer protection of confidential information. We're going to take a look first at what Browning-Ferris is all about and why you should be concerned about it, And then we will end up talking about trying to apply that in the context of protecting your confidential information. One of the questions analyzed by the NLRB and Browning-Ferris was as follows. If the board adopts a new standard for determining joint employer status, what should that standard be? And if it involves the application of a multi-factor test, what factors should be examined? What should be the basis or the rationale for such a standard? The Browning-Ferris decision was issued very recently, August 27th of 2015. The decision is currently on appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The NLRB took the position in Browning-Ferris that it was only reiterating what precedent had been by the board handed down for decades as to who are joint employers under the National Labor Relations Act. However, as we will see, I respectfully disagree with the NLRB's take on that. So what was the issue? The NLRB's decision was 3-2, but it is the law throughout the United States, at least until the circuit court reviews it. So it's very important for all of us to understand what it's talking about. And what's at stake is the concept of who qualifies as an employer, and here, by this decision, it is clearly, in our view, being expanded. So what is a joint employer? It's an otherwise unrelated entity that does not hire, fire, supervise, or determine the wages and benefits of another company's employees, but that still bears responsibilities to those employees under the NLRA. So what does that mean, and why is it relevant? Still bears responsibilities to those employees under the NLRA. The risk is threefold. First of all, an employer found to be a joint employer with another entity could be required to sit at the bargaining table with the union representatives of employees of its affiliates, including its vendors and others, its contractors. Moreover, let's say that a joint employer found to be a joint employer by the NLRB, a vendor, a contractor, et cetera, could be liable for the unfair labor practices of such joint employer, even if it itself did not engage in the conduct. Moreover, the employer could be subject to otherwise unlawful secondary activity, such as secondary picketing, if it's found to be a joint employer, because then it's stepping into the shoes of the primary employer as a joint employer. So let's understand the decision and what has changed in our view. When do two entities qualify as joint employers under the Browning-Ferris case? Well, the old standard was that two employers had to have direct and immediate control, both of them, over essential terms and conditions of employment to qualify as a joint employer. Under the new standard, two or more statutory employers are joint employers if they, quote, share or co-determine those matters governing the essential terms and conditions of employment, end quote. So they don't have to have direct and immediate control anymore. It's sufficient if they share or co-determine those matters. Moreover, and this is a critical difference, under the new test, merely having the authority to control essential terms will trigger joint employer status, even if that authority is not exercised. So let's look at this. This is a graphic depiction of what has changed under Browning-Ferris. It's a change in analyzing the right to control. There's sufficient control that may be found even if the control is reserved rather than exercised, even if it's indirect through an intermediary rather than direct and immediate. So the right to control can either be actual, as it always was, or potential, and even most remotely, reserved. Understanding the decision, let's look at what has changed. What are examples of the types of control that create joint employer liability? Setting hiring standards, control over policies and agreement templates, the right to require removal of a worker, controlling the number of workers, setting the timing of shifts, setting or enforcing productivity standards, dictating tasks to be completed, deciding where employees are stationed, and setting a ceiling on wages. Almost all of these might well exist between a company and its vendors or a company and its contractors, for example. Are there any limits? The board majority claims that the bare right to dictate results or to control or protect property is not enough to create a joint employer relationship. We'll see. A joint employer status finding also, the board says, must serve the NLRA's purpose, including encouraging collective bargaining. Well, in my opinion, the NLRB CFPB is always interested in encouraging collective bargaining, so I'm not so confident that that's going to be one that's going to end up with findings of no joint employer status. A joint employer need only bargain about what terms and conditions over which it possesses the authority to control. But again, it's the authority to control, not the actual exercise of that. So possible control may be too limited, the board says, in scope or significance to permit meaningful collective bargaining. But who knows what the board, where the board is going to draw the line. It's going to be a case-by-case analysis, the board says, and the board acknowledges great uncertainty and unknown that the law must continue to evolve. The dissent strongly asserted that the test has no limit and respectfully disagreed with the board majority. This slide basically shows all the various possibilities, and not all of them, in fact, of who could be found to be a joint employer. Start out with the parent, a corporation, or investors, or private equity concern that has control of a company. It then may have a joint employer relationship with the manufacturer, manufacturer A, that's producing the product that the company is going to be selling. It could be a retailer and the manufacturer that is making private label merchandise for the retailer. Or it could be manufacturer C, who relies on manufacturer A to produce parts, et cetera, for it. And even if you go down the line to the manufacturer A, it has part suppliers, manufacturer B. It has trucking and distribution vendors, potentially, janitorial service vendors. In addition, it may use a staffing agency to hire people for it to staff its personnel. It may have a vendor that runs its cafeteria services. All those various and sundry relationships may very well end up in a joint employer finding by the NLRB. And the problem with that is it could then wind up with the two joint employers being liable for each other's unfair labor practices, having a joint responsibility to sit down with a union representing its employees at the bargaining table, etc. So what does Browning-Ferris mean for protecting confidential information? Well, there's clearly a potential tension between protecting confidential information and indicia of joint employer status. Because if you insist that your contractor, vendor, et cetera, have non-disclosure agreements for the employees that are going to be working on your project, that's an indicia of joint employer status. Browning-Ferris focuses the joint employer analysis on whether a party has the authority to exercise control over the terms and conditions of employment. Again, not necessary that it exercise it, just in your agreement with your third-party contractors or vendors. Do you reserve the right to control the terms and conditions? Requiring an entity to include in employment policies or employment agreements a prohibition on use of disclosure of certain information may be controlled. There's no case law to date on this issue, and you need to knowingly balance the risk of a joint employer finding with the need to protect information. And on that note, I'm going to turn the mic back over to Jim McNary to discuss employer best practices.
All right. Thank you very much, Gary. So as you can see, we are, as I had signaled at the beginning of our presentation, in somewhat of a unique space from a legal perspective, both on a decisional law basis and on a statutory basis with the enactment of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. It is the case that historically the NLRB has pushed the limits on what type of information can be, in fact, protected in policies and non-disclosure agreements. There is a body of decisional law from the NLRB that says, look, if you're merely protecting so-called confidential information, that is information that's confidential but doesn't rise to the level of trade secret, perhaps that is not a lawful restriction. And that position has evolved over time, and I think the decisions have been more permissive in allowing employers to protect their confidential information. But with the enactment of the DTSA, which we expect, again, hopefully within days, there are these whistleblower provisions, which doesn't expressly reference the NLRA and its Section 7 and the protection of concerted activity. But these are all inputs in considering how an employer should in its practices and, importantly, in its agreements and policies best protect its information. And so, as Browning Ferris has put into play more than ever, if one is reaching beyond the four corners of its own organization to protect confidential and trade secret information, as Gary highlighted, reaching upstream, for instance, to a supplier. Say, for instance, your trade secret is a recipe, and you require those ingredient suppliers, which maybe you parcel out between five different vendors because you don't want any one of them to have every ingredient that you use. You require them to use non-disclosure agreements with their employees. And then your distributors. What if certain of these products that have trade secret components in them are provided to third parties yet to put into the distribution stream? So the point is that Browning Ferris has potential implications for how far reaching an employer should reach in protecting its trade secret and confidential information. And because the decision, Browning Ferris, is so new, because the DTSA is going to be very new, we'll see how these tensions between the protection of confidential information and trade secret information interplay with concerted activity. At some point, and hopefully this won't be the case, but at some point it may be a situation in which employers need to use the cliche, pick their poison. Ultimately, is it more important in the particular instance of the trade secret that is at issue to protect the trade secret and live with, if it comes to be, some action by a disgruntled employee who has said that the restrictions in the company's policies or confidentiality agreement may be too far-reaching and have tipped over into the terms and conditions of employment or compensation. Even though this is a niche example, in California, for instance, there are decisions, non-published federal decisions, but decisions nonetheless, that say commission compensation data, depending on the inputs and the variables that one uses based on percentage of sales, so on and so forth, and products sold, may in fact be information that qualifies as a trade secret. You know, query whether that is compensation information that the NLRB would say to qualify for concerted activity, that is information that can be shared freely as to the terms and conditions of employment and wages specifically. So with that said, we're going to go through some best practices. There are policies that exist and that have been longstanding that hopefully cover, as a best practice already, confidential information and protection of trade secrets. But now we are in a new era of post-DTSA, as soon as it's enacted, and what to do about the notice requirements and whether or not the employer wants to forego potentially obtaining exemplary damages and attorney's fees. And I think the answer will quickly be, of course, employers don't want to forego that and do want to comply with the notice requirements. So to go from square one to the cradle-to-grave approach, we really do need to look at inputs, both policies and agreements. Starting at the earliest stage of just identifying confidential and trade secret information. Think about such things as whether it's confidential or trade secret. Everything that is trade secret is confidential, but not everything that is confidential is trade secret. Think about whether there are hierarchies as far as qualitatively the value of your information. We have clients who literally use clean rooms and require everyone to empty their pockets, be free of devices before they enter areas that have really, really sensitive commercial information. This reference to tracers is a pretty extraordinary measure, but again, we have clients to do that. And what is a tracer? These may be strategic typos that are placed in documents that a misappropriator may not be able to readily discern, but which one could point out to a court, for instance, and be proof that the information taken was, in fact, originating from the employer. Identify the directions in which your confidential information flows. This, again, goes to the suppliers, vendors, the company, and downstream users. Review policies and agreements relating to the protection. Compliance with the DTSA notice provisions, absolutely important. There is a question as to whether the DTSA is retroactive in its effect. Because it's not yet enacted, I don't want to jump into that, but I think the intention is that it will not be retroactive. But we'll save that discussion for another day. That is to say that post-enactment agreements must comply. But as a best practice, query whether if you want to have that provision in agreements on a going forward basis and you're rolling it out to your workforce, whether logistically and as a legal matter and monetary matter, it makes sense to protect all employees and require all employees to sign the new quote-unquote compliant agreements. Compliance with NLRA Section 7, that is something that should hopefully be part of the agreements that you already have. Again, as it relates to restrictive covenants, to whom does it apply? That's a question that I think will continue to evolve over time. There is clearly a move underway where there is an open animus towards over-application of non-competes, particularly to lower wage earners. There also are cases that have taken a more critical look at even business-to-business non-compete provisions and whether or not those might be overly restrictive. And that, again, is a subject for another day. But the point is you really need to look holistically, both at your agreements with employees in particular, but also if you are, especially in light of Browning Ferris, going to insist upon certain restrictions with business partners and vendors and the like, this is something to consider. Be mindful of the interaction with trade secrets and confidential information and jurisdictions where that interaction is pronounced. And to put that simply, in California in particular, there is a strong tension between whether one can protect, quote-unquote, mere confidential information versus trade secret information. But that also is found in the tension in the NLRB decisions related to whether you can protect confidential information or what is more clearly safe to protect trade secrets. The protectable interest prong is going to continue to be key in non-compete agreements. If you don't have a legitimate basis to impose the restriction, there's really no jurisdiction that recognizes non-competes that's going to grant a non-compete if it's just to stifle competition for the sake of stifling competition. And the joint employer overlay, that simply is just a reference to Browning Ferris and the implications that we've gone over to this point. With that, it brings it to the end of our presentation today. With this screen, we've highlighted our Trading Secrets blog and Vice President Vaden speaking on the issue. Not literally, it's a photo clip, but just focusing on the tension that exists in non-competes in the administration, both through the NLRB and in some respects, the enactment of the DTSA and the whistleblower provisions, really being focused on, yes, on the one hand, protection of intellectual property, but on the other hand, making sure that that protection doesn't come at the cost of employer freedom of mobility and the right to express concerted activity in the appropriate context. So with that, thank you very much for attending today. Any questions that we haven't addressed, of which I see there are some, we will follow up with an email and address your question directly. If anyone has specific questions that you would like to ask after the presentation, you can see who we are, and our contact information is easily found on the website. And each of the registrants will also, as I understand it, receive a copy of today's slide deck. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
This concludes conclude today's webinar. Thank you for attending. You may now disconnect.